BBC London 94.9.
London's news. London's stories.
This is Ian Lee, BBC London 94.9. Well, we've made it as far as Wednesday, the last day of July. Hang on a second. That means tomorrow's August. That means it's pretty much nearly Christmas already. What happened? Virtually. Sitting in for Robert Elms all this week, and we're keeping the usual features. If you're just tuning in going, who on earth is this idiot? Don't worry. We're not going to be doing a dance music special or a hardcore thrash special. It's going to be following along the themes. We've got some cracking stuff in the show today. Before three, we've got Gino De Campo, the Italian chef, and if he doesn't bring any food in, man alive, there's going to be trouble. 1:40, Tina Dweeb and Izzy Sooty. Two excellent comedians. You probably know her from Peep Show. She does other things. She's brilliant. After one, Mark Mason's coming in. Now, Mark has written the book about travelling from Land's End to John O'Groats via a bus. Now, when this was flagged up to me, a little bit of my soul died. But I started reading it last night. It's a cracking book. Oh, it's good. This guy should be in charge of the history curriculum at school. He's made history sexy. Well, sexy maybe. Fun? Interesting. Anyway, it's a good book. Mark Mason's coming in. And before one, Russell Clark will be in, the musical Rootmaster. Today's talking about Abbey Road. Now, I'm in two minds about Abbey Road by the Beatles. Is it their best album or their second best album? If you know the answer to that Zen-like question, 020-722-42000. Being a Wednesday, it's notes and queries as well. This is where I really need you to help me out here. Otherwise, it's going to be a lot of me just talking to myself. You know how notes and queries works. You've seen something in London. You've seen someone wandering around wearing an odd suit. You've seen a strange plaque somewhere. You've seen a closed-off tunnel. There's a sign for a shop that doesn't exist anymore, and it's left you scratching your head and going, well, hang on a minute, what was that? I probably haven't got the answer, but someone in London will have the answer, and that's the beauty of this. You set the question, someone else comes up with the answer. If you've got a note or indeed a query, 020-722-42000. You can email ian.lee@bbc.co.uk. But to kick the show off, should we have a nice little bit of obscure Glen Campbell, written by Brian Wilson to say thank you for him for being a member of the Beach Boys for 6 months. Oh, yes, Glen Campbell was a Beach Boy for 6 months. Well, to say thank you, as well as no doubt giving him a huge check, Brian Wilson gave him this song, Guess I'm Dumb. That's not a bad thank you, is it? Yeah, thanks for being in the Beach Boys for 6 months. I know you don't want to do it permanently. You're going off to invent soft, adult-oriented country rock, but as a thank you, Glenn, here's a masterpiece I've written for you. Won't chart, won't get anywhere, and no one will ever remember it, but boy oh boy, I got to interview Glenn Campbell a couple of 2 years ago, just before his last tour, when it was announced he had Alzheimer's and this was going to be his big retirement. But the PR people played a slightly sneaky one. They said, oh yeah, no, he's got Alzheimer's, but it's not that bad yet, he's fine, it'll be fine, he's just a little bit forgetful. He was not a little bit forgetful. That man was very ill, and I'm still not sure that he should have been doing the PR rounds, or indeed even the concert rounds. Anyway, I mentioned Guess I'm Dumb to him. Oh, Guess I'm Dumb. He started singing it to me. Oh, my heart welled up. That's about the only thing he could remember. He couldn't remember meeting Jimmy Webb. And then, oh, and this broke my heart. At the end of the interview, it's me and my producer, and we said, OK, Glenn, well, thanks very much. Really nice to meet you. We'll be off. He came off with us. He walked away with us. We said, no, Glenn, those are your people over there. That's your wife. Oh, OK, I'll stick with it. Oh, it broke my heart. I don't think he should have been doing the rounds. But, man, what a voice. He's got a new record out as well. I must check that out. Good afternoon. This is Ian Lee, BBC London 94.9. I need your notes and queries this afternoon. I know that most of you will be regular listeners to Robert Elm, so you know how this works. There might be one or two stray listeners who have tuned in either by accident or just because they foolishly would like to hear me. How this works is, You phone up or email with your queries or thoughts or questions about things you've seen in London. Now, when I say things, it really is as open-ended as that. It can be a kind of a famous eccentric from your area, from your neck of the woods. It can be a monument you've seen. It can be a street sign. It can be a rumour that you've heard. It can be literally anything. You give me a call, 020 722 4200. I'll do my best to answer it. It's unlikely I'll be able to be honest. I'm a little bit of an idiot when it comes to things like that. But we'll certainly have a go. And if I can't answer it, well, then one of the other listeners will. That's the beauty of this. 0207 22 4 2000. You can also text them in, 81333. Start your text with London. Or you can email me, ian.lee, I-A-I-N, dot L-E-E, at bbc.co.uk. We're talking about Abbey Road a little bit later on. I love Abbey Road. It's one of my favourite places. When George Harrison died... I was very upset when George died. He was my favourite Beatle. When George died, I popped down to Abbey Road that evening just to have a little look and to kind of soak up the atmosphere a bit. It was lots of German students smoking joints, if I'm completely honest. That's who compromised it. The spirituality of the moment was missing somewhat. But I do love Abbey Road. We'll be talking to Russell Clark about it a little bit later on. But I've got a question for you. Are you one of the people that's been to Abbey Road and graffitied on the wall? Of course, the BBC does not condone any such behaviour. I think it's quite acceptable at Abbey Road, though, isn't it? They go and how often do they clean the wall at Abbey Road of graffiti? It's a shame they do. They should keep it up there permanently. Let it stay there. But have you ever written on Abbey Road, on the wall there? 020-722-4200. It is one of those... I don't think there are any other places in London where graffiti is not only applauded, but kind of vaguely encouraged. I'm sure EMI Studios, who certainly did reside there up until a certain point, wouldn't encourage the vandalisation of the wall. But I can't think of any other places in London... Hang on a minute, I'm coming up with my own query. How am I hijacking the show? Are there any other places in London, apart from the Abbey Road wall, where graffiti is not necessarily encouraged, but certainly a blind eye is turned to it? 020-722-4200. And again, please don't take this as an instruction by the BBC to go out there with your marker pens, your Sharpies and your spray cans and start writing everywhere. That's not what I'm asking at all. So, in a very clumsy roundabout way, and boy, wasn't it clumsy, I've set up two things for you there. Notes and queries. Any questions, any queries you have about London, however obscure and bizarre they are, we did this last time, and some of the... I was here a few weeks ago filling in for Robert, and we did notes and queries, and the questions that came in, I just thought, we're not going to get any answers on these. We did. We got them all answered. So, any questions about London, 020-722-4200. I'm throwing out my own question as well. Have you graffitied on the wall at Abbey Road? If so, what did you write? We'll be talking about that a bit later on with Russell Clark. And also, are there any other places in London where graffiti is not necessarily encouraged, but it's certainly, you know, a blind eye is turned to it? 0207 224 2000. You can email me, ian.lee, I-A-I-N, dot L-E-E, at bbc.co.uk, or you can send me a text, 81333. Start your text with London. Oh, James Taylor's giving guitar lessons online. Oh, it's a treat to watch. I think this weekend I need to educate my boys, 3.5 and 19 months, in the ways of James Taylor. They're already getting a fine musical education, my boys. They know all the words to not only the Monkees' greatest hits, but some of their more obscure album covers. Some of the songs that they never even released in the 60s. My boy knows the words to Nine Times Blue. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. Huh? We're talking about Abbey Road in a little bit with Russell Clark, our musical route master. And I want to know two things on the back of that. Have you ever graffitied on the wall at Abbey Road? What did you write and why? And are there any other places in London where it's okay in inverted commas, to graffiti? Now, please don't think for a second I'm in any way endorsing or encouraging you to rush out and write on walls and bits of pavement or things like that. I'm not. Okay, I'm not, but I don't think it's necessarily allowed at Abbey Road, but they kind of turn a blind eye to it, don't they? Because it's such an iconic wall. Are there any other iconic walls in London? I don't know. It's an iconic wall and an iconic zebra crossing. that, you know, people have been graffitiing on that, I guess, what, since 65, 66? I'll put all of this to Russell Clark when he comes in and tells me. For within this building, there is an expert who may well indeed have the answers. 0207 224 2000. Have you written on the wall at Abbey Road? And are there any other places in London where it is acceptable, encouraged, allowed, a blind eye is turned, that you can write on the walls? I'm trying to think of some places. I know that there's the South Bank where the skaters are. There's a lot of graffiti there. But I don't think that's quite the same thing. Because I know for a fact the South Bank would like to get rid of not only that graffiti, but that skate park. That's certainly on someone's agenda at the moment. Is there anywhere else in London? As I get older, I'm less and less of a fan of the graffiti around things. I don't particularly like it at all. But there are some bits of graffiti that are just iconic, aren't they? That have been there for so long that they're virtually parts of London. 0207 224 2000. Where else can you graffiti? And also, I do need your notes and queries this afternoon. If you've got any questions about any of the things that you may or may not have seen in London. Characters. I do like the characters in London. For a long time, there was a guy in Stoke Newington who we used to call Stokey De Niro. Anyone else see Stokey De Niro? And he was a chap with kind of long hair, and he would walk around. I mean, he's probably passed on now. This was about 20 years ago, God rest his soul. He would walk around doing the Robert De Niro, that kind of shake of the arms he does on Taxi Driver, a film I'd never seen, I hasten to add. That shake of the arms, and he would walk around, you're talking to me? You're talking to me? He would do Robert De Niro from Taxi Driver just constantly. So I'm a big fan of characters. Of course, the famous one, and his name escapes me now, although one of you will know it, was the fella who used to sell the leaflets about eating fish and various other protein-based things would lead to sexual depravity. I'm old enough to have seen that guy. He used to walk up and down Oxford Street, would sell his little booklets for tuppence. I think there was a documentary made about him, or at least he popped up in a documentary about London at some point. What was his name? Listen, Robert, I know Robert will have done this 100 times. His name escapes me. He used to walk up and down Oxford Street with, not a sandwich board, but maybe it was a sandwich board, but also a big pole with a board on, and it was about how eating protein leads to sexual depravity. It's the second time I've said that phrase on BBC London 94.9. I wonder how many times I can say it before I get the boot. Probably two. And he would sell leaflets for tuppence that he'd written himself. I believe those leaflets now are worth about £500 if you've got one of those. Who was that guy? He's famous. He's a famous London eccentric. We were talking the other day about markets in London and how London is becoming more homogenised and, you know, every high street, not only in London, across the country. Oh, there's a Gap next to a Boots, next to a WH Smith. We're losing a lot of the characters from London, aren't we? There used to be lots of... When I used to live up near Manor House, Endymion Road in Manor House... Boy, was that a strange time in my life. Our landlord was... well, we did a moonlight flit. I used to live with Mackenzie Crook. We did a moonlight flit one night because... anyway, I won't go into the details. But up that way, there was a lady we used to call Chunky Pamela Anderson, who looked exactly like Pamela Anderson, but a little bit bigger. And wore really thick makeup. And she was always running. Always running. And I think we're losing a lot of these eccentrics from London, which is a shame. So, we can celebrate... Look, I'm kind of... I'll shut up in a minute. You call in, I'll shut up. Lots of stuff thrown out there. First of all, who was the fella who used to walk up down Oxford Street with the... Don't eat fish sign? What was his name? He's famous. That's an easy one. One of you will know that. 0207 224 2000. London eccentrics. Let's celebrate and embrace the magic of the London eccentric. They are what makes this city, this town and this city, so wonderful. And I fear that we're losing them slightly. 0207 224 2000. Also, your Abbey Road stories. We'll be talking about that with Russell Clark very, very soon. And is there anywhere else in London, apart from the Abbey Road wall, where it's acceptable, if not necessarily legal, to write graffiti? 81333, start your text with London, ian.lee@bbc.co.uk, or you can give me a call, 0207-224-2000. Right, need words with you. 0207-224-2000 if you want to give me a call. Matt Baker on Facebook has certainly not understood the premise of Notes and Queries. His question is, why is it on TV everyone cheers wildly when people say, I'm from Essex? Also, why do Londoners call girls girls? I don't think he's quite understood the basic premise of Notes and Queries. Good effort, Matt, but not quite good enough. This is Ian Lee. It's BBC London 94.9. I'm sitting in for Robert Elms this week, and we got some... very excited. We're going to be talking Abbey Road in a couple of minutes. In a couple of minutes. But before that, Sheila is in Islington. Hello, Sheila.
Hi.
Sheila, what can I do for you? What have you called in for?
Well, I've actually called in. It's for a cab driver who was in a cab a couple of months ago.
Yes.
And we were talking about London, and he knew the Robert Elms show, and he said he listened to it every day.
A cab driver listening to Robert Elms? I've never heard of such a thing.
Well, they do seem to like it.
They do seem to like it. He's got something about him, yes. And what?
It was London, really. And we were going down York Way, and we were passed by St. Martin's Art College.
Yep.
New Art College, and there's this birdcage kind of sitting there. It looks a bit odd. It doesn't fit in with anything. And inside it was a swing, which kind of, they changed what they put in it from time to time.
Right.
And he said to me, well, what's that then? And I said, well, I don't really know. You should ring up Robert Elms, you see, and ask him. He'll probably find out for you. And he said, oh, I haven't got time to do that. So I said, well, I'll do it for you. And if you hear me on the radio, on the show, then you ring in. So he might ring in.
Oh, Sheila, is this like a little sort of on-air flirting with a cab driver? Was there a spark that day?
No, not really.
So this cage by St. Martin's Art College, is it a permanent fixture?
I think it is, because I've seen it there. It's permanent. I'm not sure, but they changed what they put in it.
How big is it? Could you fit a human in?
About 12 foot high, it's a huge, you know, it's like a big bird cage.
Right, like the old-fashioned kind of bird cage.
Yes, with like a dome shape.
And what was in it the day that you drove past?
A swing.
Right.
And the swing couldn't go anywhere, you see, so obviously it was trapped in the cage.
Oh, I see. That's probably a statement about humankind and the way we're heading in this internet age or something.
Yeah, but it just looked odd because it was just stuck there, you know, where the petrol filling station used to be, and it's just a big space there now.
And how long ago was this, Sheila?
About 2 or 3 months, but I did pass it a few weeks ago, and I did see that the cage was still there, but the swing had gone, so I don't know if they changed it or what it was meant to symbolise.
And is it directly outside St. Martin's College?
More or less opposite, on the road, yeah, more or less. Not on the, it's on the other side of the road, I think, as far as I remember, yeah. And that little.
You just reminded me, do you remember in Trafalgar Square, when they were deciding what to do, as they always are, with the fourth plinth, and they had that fantastic idea where people could go and stand on the plinth for an hour?
I do remember that, yes. I never got down there.
I got down there and had a little look, and I watched it online. Did you think that was a good idea, or did you think that was a little bit naff?
No, I thought it was an interesting idea. Yeah, better than Nelson's Column any day.
It is better than Nelson's Column. You're right. Sheila, listen, I appreciate your call. Keep listening, because we may get your cab driver may call in, but even if he doesn't...
Tell him to call in if you're there.
he will be listening. Thank you very much, Sheila. So, here we go. This is our first notes and query of the day. Sheila wants to find out that the cage, bird cage, opposite St. Martin's Art College, what is it? How long has it been there? Is it just an arty installation that the students thought, oh, this will be a good wheeze, let's whack this up and we can put a different thing every month? Or has it been there for a long time? There was a swing in it a couple of months ago. If you're driving past that way, and I know that Robert does have a lot of cabbies driving and listening to the show, if you are driving past it, could you have a little look? Give me a call and let me know what's in it right now. 020-722-42000. You can text 81333. Start your text with London. In a second, we'll be talking to Russell Clark, our musical route master, about, it's about Abbey Road, which I can't work out if it's my favourite or my second favourite Beatles album. I'm never quite sure. But this is from it, and this is definitely one of my favourite Beatles songs of all time. Here comes the sun. It's just a perfect song, isn't it?
Very nice.
It's just perfect. Here we go. Then listen to this ending. It's all right. Oh, man alive. It's one of those songs that is... by the way, I'm joined by Russell Clark, musical
group master.
Hello, Russell, yes. It's one of those songs that we've heard so many times that we kind of become deaf to how brilliant and how beautiful it is. It's like, oh, here comes the song by the Beatles again. But if you listen to it as though you've never listened to it before, that guitar is just so fresh. And what I heard then, which I don't always hear, is that very subtle use of the synthesizer.
The Moog synthesizer.
And it is Moog. I had an argument with somebody about this the other day. Yes, of course it's Moog. Robert Moog.
He was one of the first people to get it, yeah. It was two keyboards and a thing that almost filled the studio at Abbey Road. He was one of the first people to get one. You didn't know how to use it. That's as far as they got.
But they could have gone so over the top with the Moog on the album, and it's just that subtle. Do you know the first rock album to feature a Moog synthesizer?
Go on.
Pisces, Aquarius, Capricorn and Jones Limited by the Monkees.
Mickey, is it really?
Mickey Dolenz bought the first one, and he's the first one. They did go a little over the top with it.
I have that somewhere. I don't play it a lot.
Oh, it's good. I'm a big Monkees fan. Now, listen, Russell, you're in. We've played a song from Abbey Road, because this week it is Abbey Road, and you were telling me you're allowed to do it this week because Robert is off, and as people know, he's not a Beatles fan.
He's not a Beatles fan at all. I have to wait till he goes on holiday before I can even think of doing something on the Beatles.
That upsets me.
And in this case, the photograph that... Because normally, talking about a photograph on the radio, not brilliant.
It doesn't work.
But I think everybody might know this one, and it was taken on Friday, August the 8th, 1969, so 43 years ago, 44 years ago, so my maths is wrong. When? Next week? What is it today?
It's the first tomorrow, I think. Okay, so, we've got a week.
So, fairly safe ground talking about an album sleeve. It's interesting you thought that it was your favourite. It's actually the best-selling Beatles album.
That surprises me a lot. I would have thought it would have been, A Hard Day's Night, or one of the earlier ones from the height of Beatlemania.
Well, to some extent, that's worldwide. Early in their career, the Beatles in America, they played catch-up. So often, Revolver was... had about six songs from what we know as Revolver.
Oh, yeah.
And then about four songs from what were held over from Rubber Soul. There was Yesterday and Today. There was all sorts of different albums. So they sort of diluted their sales to some extent in America. So I think, the first one that came out...
Sgt. Pepper.
So they're beginning to, that's where the big sales are. And then in the 80s, it comes out again on CD.
Yeah.
And so it gets another boost. But it is the biggest selling Beatles album. It was at number one for 11 weeks, then dropped to number two, and then went back to number one for 6 weeks. And was humongously successful in America, as most of the Beatles sung stuff is.
Because a lot of people don't realise that, as you say, a lot of the early Beatles albums in the States are not the Beatles albums that we
very
know.
Very different track.
Brian Wilson always talks about how Rubber Soul was the inspiration for Pet Sounds. He wasn't hearing the same Rubber Soul as us. He was hearing a folk album, pretty much, which is completely different. By the way, I have to say this, huge Beatles fan. Pet Sounds, Sgt. Pepper, a little bit overrated.
If we were arguing in the saloon bar with a pint night, I'd say Revolver every time, I think. I mean, it depends on one's mood, but I think certainly the movie soundtracks, but Revolver would get it. Pepper is more about technology, how they harness what's quite limited technology and made a fantastic record. But it's slightly more of its time. I think if you were in 1967 listening to that, you'd think, the world would change.
Yeah.
Whereas, 40-odd years later on, it might not have quite the same resonance. I think the energy of Revolver would always give it the...
It's between Revolver and Abbey Road for me. It flips between the two. But
I've been listening to Abbey Road a lot more in the last few days when I've been putting these notes together. Excuse me. And particularly the medley on side two, I think, is just fantastic.
Oh, it's just a... you have a little cough, don't worry. It's a masterpiece. Do you want some water?
I've got some.
It's a masterpiece. That medley is just...
But it was snippets of songs that it was like a minute and a half of this and they didn't know what to do with it. And then I always thought that it was edited and speeded up and all the rest of it. Actually, it was recorded as a medley. Much of it was done together. They were just sort of piecing together bits and elements that they had together and made that long, and it depends where you think the medley starts, but it does. It's a terrific piece
and
of
Her
music,
Majesty actually. Which is the track right at the end, the 20 second kind of fade out groove that comes in, that was part of the medley as well. Where was that going to pop up in the medley? I can't remember.
Well, I don't know that they actually fixed on that. The thing is, there's a small gap at the end there and it just sort of lurches in, and that's because the engineer who was transferring the tape to whatever they do left a bit of sticky tape on it. And then they just played it and liked how it sounded. One of those things. It's quite a spontaneous record, actually. They made it in the summer of 1969 at Abbey Road, not surprisingly, and pretty much everything's at Abbey Road, and which is the EMI Studios, obviously, in at number 3 Abbey Road, NW8, which was originally a house, 9-bedroom house originally, and they bought it for £16,500 in 1929 and converted it into a recording studio.
Hang on, so how much in 1929?
£16,500.
That's a staggering amount.
Nine-bed, five-reception house, which was originally number 2 Abbey Road, and then it expanded and became number 3 Abbey Road. To convert it to what it is now, they bought number 5 Abbey Road, knocked that down, and they also bought many of the gardens, or portions of gardens of houses in Hill Road and Alma Square, which are the ones just at the back. They're all rather nice property these days. And the whole thing cost £100,000, and it opened in November 1931 with the LSO recording Land of Hope and Glory, conducted by Sir Edward Elgar. How appropriate. So, and it's been there ever since. And then, you know, got a bit of Glenn Miller, got a bit of Cliff Richard, a bit of Adam Faith.
A lot of Peter Sellers and the Goons.
Peter Sellers and the Goons,
the George
indeed.
Martin connection,
Rolf Harris,
wasn't it?
If you may mention him. And then the Beatles, obviously, who did 90% of everything that they ever released was kind of done at Abbey Road. They did little bits elsewhere.
And it still has that mythical kind of appeal, doesn't it? It's still a thrill when bands say, oh, we're recording at Abbey Road, or we're doing a session at Abbey Road.
I suspect it is. There were 3 studios, a huge one for orchestras, and then they were mainly in Studio 2, which, if anybody's seen any photographs, is the one that has a wooden staircase up the side, up to the control room, and, I'm reliably informed, has linen bags, or did, in the 1960s, have linen bags of seaweed hanging from the high ceiling to help with acoustics.
Fantastic.
There you go. And so the Beatles first came there in 1962, and they auditioned for George Martin. They've been passed on by almost everybody. Then they came back in September to actually do some recording, by which point they had got a new drummer, Ringo Starr. And that was it. And they were off, and they made so much money for EMI that basically they could just go in and, normally charges for the studio charge back to the group. And they were just making so much money, they said, well, you can have as long as you like. And so by the time they get to Abbey Road, they had... they used that to their benefit, because Paul McCartney lived around the corner. They just turned up and had, just block book time and got in there and did
it
themselves.
It's odd for a band, I think, to have such an association with a studio, because particularly in the 60s, lots of other bands were trying different studios to experiment with sound. I mean, the Stones would go and record at Olympia, but then they'd also record when they were in the States.
All the prime Stone stuff is done in Los Angeles. Mm. It was about, the thing about Abbey Road is actually they had all these fantastic engineers in grey coats, but it was actually technologically not very advanced. It had like 4-track as opposed to 8-track was fairly standard. So it was behind the curve, but it just had the acoustics. I mean, everybody wanted that sound. And so, and the sound that came from the Beatles, because that was then exported to America in this whole British invasion of 64 and 65. And they all wanted that sound. And that's what, fired Brian Wilson's imagination much of the time.
Well, that and a large quantities of illegal
and
substances.
As well, yes.
At what point did the technicians ditch the white coats? Because it was treated like a laboratory, wasn't it?
I'm not sure. Well into the 70s, certainly after the Beatles finished.
Wow.
They got an 8-track recorder in 1968, which is what they used for this. Before that, it had been 4-track, and, just very clever the way they used it to get all the sounds that are on Sgt. Pepper. I'm not a huge fan of the White Album, which was apparently a miserable, miserable experience for most of them. They were, Brian Epstein had died, they were getting arrested for drugs, John Lennon had left his wife, the Magical Mystery Tour had been a bit of a flop, really, and that was their first critical panning. And they were just months and months in the studio making this massive album, and then they Let It Be, which was a documentary that was meant to be about them being creative and making their album, actually just was basically them disintegrating. And so I think they sort of knew it was going to be their last record, and they just up their game a little bit.
And that was it, because George Martin didn't work on Let It Be. I mean, eventually he handed the tapes over to Spectre. But he said, look, I'll come back and do one more record, but...
All got to be there.
We've got to do it the way we used to do it. You've got to do it as a band.
Ironically, there's not that many songs where they're all on it together, certainly not at the same time. There's lots of overdubbing and, John's... There's a couple of songs, Maxwell's Silver Hammer, which is not my favourite song.
but
I have to say, they have an anvil on that.
Yep.
And that is a real anvil and not a sound effect. Because I suppose that's so much money at that point. They sent their roadie out, Mal Evans, to buy an actual anvil and drag it into the studio. Actually, he rented it from a theatrical agency. But he actually dragged it, and Ringo couldn't get the timing of the hammer on the anvil. So Mal Evans plays gets the anvil credit on
you
that.
You can see, if you ever see Let It Be, which is available on dodgy cassettes, it's not available legitimately.
No.
They keep saying, oh, next year we're going to release it. It never comes out, and it's because
I think it's in their plans. They're very shrewd the way
they should
do.
It's a cracking film, but you can see them rehearsing Maxwell's Silver Hammer on that, and Mal Evans sat there with a massive anvil, and you just think, oh, that poor fella, what they put him through.
Well, Lennon refused, he hated it so much, he refused to play on it. He's not on it anyway. anywhere at all.
Is he not?
He sat in the corners of the studio when they were doing overdubs of hand claps and
it's one of my
voices and things and refused to get involved.
It's one of my favourite albums, as I said, one of the top two favourite albums by the Beatles. It's got two of my least favourite Beatles songs, Maxwell Silver Hammer and Come Together, a song I've never quite seen the fascination with.
No, an interesting song. I quite like that, but I think I like, a bit like Robert, who he likes... doesn't like the Beatles, he likes versions of Beatles songs.
Right.
So there are versions. The Meters in particular do a really great version of that. But that was the song that Lennon got sued by the public Chuck Berry's publisher because he nicks a couple of lines and a riff from a Chuck Berry song called You Can't Catch Me. So by way of settlement, John Lennon promised to record three of Chuck Berry's songs, or actually songs that this guy published for his next album, which was Rock and Roll. If you remember in the mid-70s,
yes.
He did a kind of a rock and roll retro.
Yes,
that,
again, another Phil Spector production, I think.
Yes, and so Come Together, I quite like. I Want You So She's So Heavy, I Could Be Happy If I Never Heard That Again.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
I
a couple,
love...
a couple of flimsy things like...
I love that hypnotic... Whoa, hang on a second, we're about to fall out here. let's deal with what these crimes one at a time. I Want You She's So Heavy, just that repetitive, dirty riff, that it becomes almost a dirge towards the end, I think is wonderful. And sorry, because is a... What did you call it? It's a lightweight throwaway thing.
I thought it was a bit lightweight.
The harmonies on it... The work, the concentration, the vocals in that, I think it's a masterpiece.
I think I Want You is an evidence of John Lennon's total besottedness with mad Japanese conceptual artist Yoko Ono, because he at that time he changed his middle name from Winston to Ono as well.
Yep.
And as they started recording the album in July 1969, he had a car accident in Scotland. And he had 17 stitches and was in hospital for 5 days. And Yoko also had several stitches, and she was pregnant at the time. So when they got back to London, Lennon had Harrods deliver a double bed into Studio 2 at Abbey Road so that she could sit in the bed, and there was a microphone on a boom above so she could add her thoughts while they were recording. She also invited her friends to join her there just for chats, and apparently walked around in a flimsy nightgown and a tiara which was meant to cover the scar on her face. And there was a bit of an incident I read where, strangely enough, they all were very possessive about their own food. They could go to the canteen, but they also brought their own food with them. And George Harrison bought a packet of McVitie's digestives, and they're all upstairs apart from Yoko. Yoko's downstairs in the bed. They're up in the control room at Studio 2 listening to a playback, and George Harrison watched Yoko Ono get out of bed, walk across the length of the studio and nick a couple of his digestives, and he went mental, apparently. He was spare. And Lennon and Harrison almost came to blows over the honour of his woman, I suppose.
Yes, less so than the digestives.
Yeah, so it's a fairly rocky album. They were sort of, you know, cooperating together,
but it was tense.
We've
only got 2 minutes left, because I do want to squeeze in You Never Give Me Your Money.
Yeah.
This is one of the albums that proved conclusively that Paul McCartney was actually dead. There were enough clues on here to tell the world that McCartney had died in a car crash, weren't there?
Well, the cover is them processing across the crossing outside Abbey Road, of course, but that's supposed to symbolise a funeral procession. It was all a joke, and it's amazing how it, you know, went viral in a way that things do now in seconds because of the internet. But in 1969, that sort of infrastructure wasn't available. But it was a joke in a satirical newspaper in Iowa, which then got picked up by some DJs in Detroit, and all of a sudden it was all over the world that he was dead. So if you play Bits of Strawberry Fields Forever backwards, it's supposed to say I Buried Paul, doesn't it? It says Cranberry Sauce, actually. And then there's a funeral procession on, and the fact that McCartney's barefoot on the sleeve, it was that very hot day, he took his shoes off.
Yep.
But it's actually meant to be symbolise the corpse. If they had an album out called The Collection of Beatles Oldies, OL dies.
Okay,
and
yes.
OL is P and M. What is one letter before P and M? So that meant PM dies. And this was around the time that HAL, the computer in 2001 A Space Odyssey, was supposed to be IBM, but just shifted by one letter on the alphabet.
Brilliant.
So all that sort of paranoia, yes.
There was... I'm watching a brilliant documentary. It's just people who met or worked with the Beatles, sorry. And one of them is an engineer who worked with the Beatles. And he got a phone call saying, have you heard the news? Paul McCartney's dead. Have you heard the news? Paul McCartney said, no, he's not dead. He's dead. You've got to phone up and check. So he phoned up Paul McCartney. Apparently he woke him up at 5 o'clock in the morning. And Paul McCartney goes, what are you doing calling me at 5 in the morning? Paul, we've just heard you're dead. Is that true? McCartney goes, of course I'm not dead now. Go away.
Yes.
Go away in no uncertain terms. It is one of those wonderful 60s.
He seemed to let it go for a couple of months until he gave an interview to Life and said, actually, I've just been a bit quiet.
He was replaced by a Scottish actor, wasn't he?
Who won a Paul McCartney lookalike contest, yeah. Fantastic.
Shame on Robert Elms.
A few too many drugs, I think.
Shame on Robert Elms for not letting you talk about the Beatles. I could talk all day about this, Russell. Thank you so much for coming in. I'm going to play You Never Give Me Your Money, because, again, it's just one of those Beatles songs that's kind of ignored a bit. It's got lost in amongst their great canon of songs. So from Abbey Road, You Never Give Me Your Money. Oh, I've got Beatles goosebumps all down my back. Scott disagrees with Abbey Road being such a good album. Scott has tweeted me. Come Together, not very good. I'm rephrasing. Maxwell Silverhammer, not very good. Oh Darling is average. Ergo, side one of Abbey Road is not very good. I disagree. Harsh. Harsh. This is Ian Lee, BBC London, 94.9.
BBC London, 94.9.
London's news. London's stories.
Afternoon, this is Ian Lee, BBC London 94.9, sitting in for Robert Elms. I enjoyed that last hour. Maybe too much, who knows? I hope you got some of the pleasure out of two Beatles fanboys banging on about Abbey Road. Well, in this hour, I'll be speaking to Tian and Dweeb and Izzy Sutty about the Phoenix Fringe Festival. I'm also going to talk to Mark Mason, writer and explorer extraordinaire. But also, it's Wednesday, so that means notes and queries. These are your concerns, your thoughts, your ideas, your dilemmas, things you've spotted in and around London that you'd like answered. Well, earlier we spoke to Sheila. She called in about a giant 12-foot birdcage outside St. Martin's College. I went past it a couple of months ago, and there was a swing in there. The swing's gone. Have you seen it recently? Do you know, is it an old birdcage that's been there for a long time, or is it something a bit arty? One of the students has done. And what's in there now? 0207 22 4 2000 with your answers to that, and also your own queries. Now, interestingly, Sheila, when she called in, she mentioned she'd spotted this whilst in the back of a cab. She kind of dared the cabbie to call up. He went, I ain't got time, love. I don't know if you talk like that. So she called up on his behalf. Well, he has now called up and he's on the line. Rod, you are that cabbie, aren't you?
Yes, I am. Hello, Ian. Yes, I heard Sheila on the line 25 minutes ago and she put me to shame. I did mean to ring weeks and weeks ago, but didn't. We went on that journey. We went past this birdcage, looking quite incongruous because it was a beautiful, I think it's a bit of artwork, a beautiful birdcage, all lit up, neon signs, in good way, just behind King's Cross.
And so is this an old birdcage, Rob, that's been there for a long time, or do you think it's part of the college that's been put up recently?
It went up about a year ago, when they were still doing works in Goods Way. It has gone from there. I saw it the other day further up York Way now, it's been moved. But it was, as I say, very incongruous, but it's a lovely thing. And if it is a bit of artwork, it would just be nice to know if there was, why it was there, what was the thing behind it, because it did just look like a canary's cage with a swing in it.
It's a moving birdcage. Well, listen, if anybody knows anything about this, let's see if we can put a name to the person who's responsible, or if we know why it's there or where it comes from. Where did you say it was now, Rod?
I think it's now further up Goods Way, over on the west side. It looks a bit forlorn. It doesn't seem to be on show anymore. I think from what I remember, it's sort of behind a fence further up Goods Way.
0207 22 4 2000. Now, to make up for not having called in weeks ago and being a very naughty cabbie, Rod, you've got a query of your own, have you?
Yes, I have. Well, I've run with this one a couple of times, but never got through. Admiralty Arch, which, as we all know, is at the end of the Mall and Trafalgar Square.
Yep.
Has got three arches. The traffic passes through the two outer arches.
Yep.
And the middle arch, which is normally closed and is only open for ceremonial events, has got a lantern hanging down from it, sort of Georgian lantern with four panes of glass. one of those panes of glass, which is usually facing up the mall, is red, but the other panes of glass are clear. So if you're viewing it from one side, the light will appear red. From the other side, it'll appear clear. And I'm just intrigued to know why that is.
One would have to assume that that's sending some kind of signal, isn't it? That's giving out some sort of information. Now, red is always, as my 3.5-year-old boy will tell me, means danger or stop. But why would they be sending out a signal like that?
Well, I've no idea, and that's hopefully what the rest of London's going to let me know.
Oh, now, see, listen, I do love listening to Notes and Queries, but I also find it quite frustrating as well, because I want to know the answer and I don't. Okay, so it's Admiralty Arch. It's the middle arch, the Georgian lantern with four sides, three of them are clear glass, and one is red glass.
Now, there must be a reason for it.
There's got to be a reason, and I know from listening to Robert's show, if anybody can answer it, it's the listener. 0207 224 2000. Why on earth would it have different coloured glass? Rod, thank you very much for that. Keep listening, and I'm sure we'll get an answer before 3 o'clock.
I will just say hello to Sheila for me. Thank you.
We will do. There we go. Isn't that nice? Isn't that nice? We've connected a fare with a cabbie. That's lovely. Although it's left me with a headache now. We got the birdcage that Sheila and Rod saw, and the query that's been puzzling Rod is the lantern in the middle arch, the Admiralty Arch. Why can't I say Admiralty? Oh, I just did. Three of the panes of glass are clear, one is red. Now, it would be red, you'd think, because it's sending out some sort of signal, whether a warning or a danger or something, or a stop. It's not an old-fashioned traffic light, is it? No. Don't pull a face like that. It could be. You never know. 0207 224 2000. We've got another one as well. We've got Carl. Hello, Carl, in the city.
Hello there. Yeah,
Carl, what's your query?
Just driving around today, went past Holborn Circus and noticed that they've started to remove, or they have already removed, the statue, and the plinth is now going of the Prince Albert statue in the middle of Holborn Circus.
They've taken it down.
The whole thing's going. There's a big crane there taking the marble plinth. The statue looks like it's already been removed, and the marble plinth is now being demolished or taken away. I just wondered if, because of the layout of the junction being changed, is it coming back? It's rather a large landmark. I think it's actually one of the points on the knowledge. So to find out whether or not it's coming back or where it's being relocated to, because it's been there, obviously, it's a statue of Queen Victoria's husband. It's been there for many, many years. He's seated on a horse.
I know the statue you mean, and that's I'm not quite sure how one moves or destroys a plinth, because those things aren't that light.
Well, it looks like a large Jenga puzzle. They've taken the marble pieces apart, and there's several workmen there scratching their heads. So, if the whole thing is going to be going.
I would have thought they would have had to have put it. I can't quite picture in my head how the layout is going to change. But they would have had to have, if not put it in exactly the same place, put it very nearby, wouldn't they? They can't just move it miles away.
Again, I don't know, but if it is being moved, the chances are it's not coming back. It's then got to be moved to another location. The entire junction's being worked on for the next several months, and just as a side issue for all the other cab drivers listening, Stonecutter Street is now into Farringdon. So you
say that again, Carl. You just cut out there. Stonecutter Street. What's happening?
Stonecutter Street is for a few months.
Right,
because
been closed.
Of this work.
Okay, Carl. Listen, I'm going to let you go just because the line isn't great. We keep getting keep dropping out there. But your question is definitely valid and holds good. The statue of Prince Albert on a horse in the middle of Holborn Circus. It's being moved by crane. That's going to be a big job, moving that. Lifting that bad boy up. That's going to be tough. Is it coming back? They're redoing Holborn Circus, of course, and it is a bit of a nightmare around there if you've seen it. I haven't had to drive in central London on a weekday for a long, long time. Thank goodness for that. Is that statue coming back? I would have thought it would have had to have come back. If not exactly in the same place, at least pretty near it. And is it part of the knowledge? Any cabbies listening? Is it part of the knowledge? 0207 22 4 2000. The statue of Prince Albert in the middle of Holborn Circus. It's being moved. It's been moved already. Where's it going? Is it coming back? Are we ever going to see it again? So we've got that. We've got the birdcage that's moving around near St Martin's College, and also Admiralty Arch. The lantern in the middle. Why is one of the sheets of glass in the lantern red? Come on. Come on, don't let me down. Don't leave me looking like a plum. 0207 22 42000. If you know the answer to these, you can also text 81333, excuse me. Start your text London. Or you can send me an email, ian.lee@bbc.co.uk. Bit of Dolly Parton, why not? Lovely bit of Dolly Parton. You can't go wrong. Well, you can a little bit. I saw her in concert a few years ago. She was miming. She was miming. Not all of it, but I'm convinced there are a couple of songs where Dolly Parton, and I paid £200 a ticket, was miming. Very, very naughty. The voice you can hear chuckling in the background, Mark Mason, writer and explorer. Hello, Mark.
Hello, Ian.
Now, Mark, I'm aware of your work because you're the gentleman that wrote the book. Did you walk all of the tube lines?
Overground. The lines. That was the last one, yeah.
How did... Why did you do... We'll get on to your new book, Move Along, Please, in a second, which is I'm enjoying thoroughly. It's a cracking read. You can pull that to you. Go on, you pull it and I'll turn you off. That's it.
I'm trying to do it without creaking, but there's the creak.
There's you go. We got the creak. So you walked along all of the tube lines. Why?
Because it's there. Right. As George Mallory said of Everest, that was a book about London and I wanted a deliberately slow way of exploring London,
yep.
So that you would really get into it and explore what you feel about it and all the trivia and the history, but also, you know, the stuff about your relationship with the city that I love.
And as a result of doing that, do you feel kind of more ownership of London, that
absolutely.
You know it better now?
Yeah. And that's why the new one, the bus book, going from Land's End to John O'Groats, it's the same thing with Britain. It's a deliberately slow way of, you know, local buses going from one end of the country to the other. It's sort of a completeness. You know, if once you've actually conquered something, you sort of own it and you know the history and the trivia because you've learned it all as you've gone through, and also reassess your relationship.
I do have to say this, because this book was handed to me yesterday and I looked at it and thought... Really? A fella's got a bus from Land's End to John O'Groats? That's going to be fun.
46 buses, Ian. Don't do me down.
And it's not National Express. These are proper number 62.
It had to be a local bus, yeah.
Okay, and I got home. I thought, well, I'll have a little look at it. I was hooked. I was, honestly, I'm not just saying this because you're here. It is brilliant because you've got your personality in it. And
but
that
apart from that, it's good, yeah.
Apart from that, you've got, it's just a stupid thing to do, which I enjoy. But you've made history. You've got lots of historical and local and British facts in there that if you were to read, if these were presented in a history lesson, you go, oh, flipping heck, yeah. Really? How boring. But you've made it fun. This book should be on the national curriculum. I genuinely mean that. Because it's British history and
Ian,
it's made fun.
You. I think I've just spotted a quote for the paperback. that's what I love doing, is the stupid stuff. But you think of it as just trivia and little pub facts. Well, to give you a literal example of that, a fact about a pub, the Royal Oak. You know where the name, the Royal Oak?
I haven't got a clue.
It's about the third or fourth most popular pub name in the country.
Yes.
It comes from the tree that Charles II hid in Shropshire when he was running away from Oliver Cromwell's forces. Oliver Cromwell had just beaten his dad, Charles I, and had captured him. And Charles II, as he was to become 12 years later, is on the run and hides in an oak tree in Shropshire from Cromwell's forces. And literally, one of Cromwell's troops walked underneath the tree, and the future king is hiding up this tree. And that's why we commemorate it with the name the Royal Oak.
The fact that's maybe not quite so historical, but I've been boring my friends with all day, J.D. Weatherspoon's, the chain of pubs, of course, as I thought, named after a certain Mr. J.D. Weatherspoon of some great distinction and standing. But no, not at all, according to your book.
Cited by a brilliant guy called Tim Martin, who is rescuing the pub. All this rubbish about the pub is dying. The pub... A lot of useless pubs have been dying, but he does brilliant pubs in a brilliant way. Some people don't like them, but
some people think they're soulless, but he is getting people into pubs
and they are great old buildings, and they know the history of every building they take over that person. But you're right, he started in 1979. He's called Tim Martin. Weatherspoon.
So it starts in 1979 already. That's me shocked. Okay.
Mr. Weatherspoon was a teacher at Tim Martin's school who told Tim Martin that he would never amount to anything. And he then, just to make it that bit more believable with the initials, he took the initials J.D. from J.D. Boss Hogg in The Dukes of Hazzard, which to blokes of our age, Ian, brings back memories of Daisy Duke and those shorts.
As soon as I read that, I thought, oh, I'm keeping this book. This book is staying with me. And it's full of stuff like that. It's also, there are also some quite sad bits, because you pick out bits of conversation conversation that you hear on the bus journey or as you're walking through towns. I'm only on page 53 because I'm reading this properly. I'm not doing a little flick through. And there's a horrible bit where the first little town that you stop in, and there are two women and a man, and the older woman is kind of being pulled away from a child. Mm. And she's going, oh, let me just see him one more time.
Yeah.
No, and you don't get any more to it.
Human drama. That's the beauty of it. You always have to invent the story yourself. You know, if you then stopped and asked them about it and made it turn it into a big thing, it wouldn't have that same human drama. But also the humorous stuff as well. On my bus from Wells to Bristol on the second day, because it took me, that was in Wadebridge, the incident.
Wadebridge, yes.
Which was the end of my first day. It took me five buses to get from Land's End to Wadebridge. And I looked at the map of Britain and thought, you're joking. This is
I've hardly touched it.
And Cornwall appeared like a lift shaft. And Bristol was at the top of it. And I was like a man crawling up the side of the lift shaft to try and get to Bristol. Finally managed it, got from Wells to Bristol. And on that bus, there were two very elegant, 50s, maybe early 60s, women who had been out buying kids' books for their grandson, for their grandchildren. One of them had got Saturday Night at the Dinosaur Stomp, and the other one had got Henry's Pirate Adventure. Mm. And these two very elegant 50-something women were sitting on the bus, and one of them read Saturday Night at the Dinosaur Stomp, and the other one started reading Henry's Pirate Adventure. And they fell into absolute silence as they turned the pages, and they read them. These are kids' books, aimed at like three-year-olds, so it takes you like 2 minutes to read it. And then they both closed their books, finished at the same time, and then they swapped so they could each read the other book.
Fantastic.
And then there's another couple of minutes when they're in silence looking at that, and then they closed the books up and said, they're brilliant, aren't they?
And
it was just a beautiful moment. Those little things that you only see on buses.
Isn't that wonderful? I am a fan of the bus, despite my luxury showbiz lifestyle. if I've got the time, I'll always get the bus everywhere, because you see so much... Yeah. In the bus and outside of the bus that you don't see if you're driving or getting the tube.
And it slows you down, and it's a very hard thing to do. When I was trying to do it from one end, it ended up being 1,100 miles, Land's End, up through the middle of the country to John O'Groats. 46 buses. And on the first day, that's like I say, having got to Wadebridge and thinking, how long is this going to take? I started to think of it as the Tao of bus, was the state of mind that you have to enter. And I lost it again at a couple of points. I'd start to get impatient. In the Lake District, I had a moment of going, oh, I've just still got Scotland. Have you seen Scotland on the map? It's like someone's hammered it out on an anvil. It's so long a thing. But once you're in that state, you pick up on the things that you don't notice. Because whenever you travel around your home country, you take it for granted, and you're rushing to get somewhere, and you never notice it. But I noticed on every bus going through every village, God knows how many villages I went through, every one of them's got a war memorial. Mm. And it starts, and I always look at the names on those, and you think
you mentioned quite early on that you always have a slight dilemma when you look at war memorials.
It's that because we're sort of glorying in it. There are 54,000 war memorials in Britain.
Wow!
And we're glorying in it because we're saying, "Great, we conquered the world." I used the stat later on in the book that we've invaded in Britain's history. We've invaded every country in the world. There are now just under 200 countries in the world. Mm. Of those 200, Britain has invaded every country except 22.
Wow. We better get a move on. Guys, come on. What's going on here? We're letting the side down.
Come on, Secretary of State for Defence, are you listening? And also, there wasn't a single year. Victoria was on the throne in 1837 to 1901. There wasn't a single year of Victoria's reign when our troops weren't in action somewhere around the world. And so I started to think about our relationship with war. And again, some trivia came into that, like Blenheim Palace. Mm. Churchill's ancestor, the first Duke of Marlborough, was given Blenheim Palace as his reward for winning the Battle of Blenheim. And he got Capability Brown, the landscape gardener, to set out the trees in the grounds of Blenheim Palace, to plant them in the formation of his victorious troops at the Battle of Blenheim. So those trees are standing up. And that's how much we relish it. But then I feel guilty about, war's not a good thing, So there's all sorts of complicated relationships.
One of my boy's 3.5, and one of his favourite places is the RAF Museum in North London, which is great. Yeah. But again, it's another place celebrating killing. And so I have to kind of go around them. He's pointing at all the bombs, and I kind of have to say, listen, just, bombs aren't brilliant, and a lot of these planes, they're important, but we're kind of revelling in something that's maybe slightly inappropriate. Yeah. What was your favourite place that you ended up in? Was there a place that was a real surprise to you at how
plenty
you got
of
on
places
with
that were surprises, yeah. Towards the end, I wanted the sort of local hero moment at the end. I wanted a village like the village in Local Hero, a Scottish fishing village on the coast with impenetrable Scottish accents. Yep. That's going to be good for the book, nice bit of colour. So I get up to Edinburgh, up through the Highlands, get to Inverness. I think, right, it's going to start now. North of Inverness. I'd never been to Inverness. I think the furthest north I'd been was Edinburgh.
Yeah.
I think this is where I'm going to get my local hero moment. get to all the villages on the coast, the east coast, going up towards John O'Groats, and they are 45-50% English people. There are so many people from England who've moved up there. Just staggering. Yeah. And I went into one pub, and it was full of builders from the East End.
How you doing?
And they were watching. Oh, this was such a lovely sort of human drama moment. There's a quiz. They're watching the telly. It was about 5 o'clock. I was way between buses. So I had a pint while I was between buses. And they were watching a quiz show. And as far as I could tell, the gist of this quiz show was it mixed up very, very hard questions with very, very easy ones.
Yeah.
And the first question was, in fluid dynamics, the Kármán constant is represented by which letter of the Greek alphabet? Complete silence. Second question, which key is represented by E flat and B flat? Which minor key? Complete silence. Third question, Mr. Blobby had colours of which colour on a pink on a yellow background? And the whole pub went pink. And then one of the builders sitting near the telly turned around to his mates. He went, "We found the level, haven't we, chap?"
Listen, it is a cracking book, and it's Mark Mason. Move along, please. Which cleverly spells map.
You're crediting me with a coincidence. It's when I'd had the idea, then I realised that fact. I thought, yeah, that's got to be the title.
Land's End to John O'Groats by Local Bus. It genuinely is. It's a very funny book, and it's a cracking book, and there's lots of pathos in there as well. Before I let you go, we've had a query from, it was from Carl, wasn't it? Yes, he wants to know about the Holborn Circus. The statue has been lifted, the plinth is gone like a giant Jenga puzzle. You know what's happening to it.
Only because, going back to the last book, the London book, which is the one that gave me my Twitter address, by the way, if anyone wants.
Yes.
You very kindly tweeted at Walk the Lines LDN.
Yep.
Ian tweeted the Wetherspoon fact very kindly. But that was the book about London. And through that, I know the chief planning officer of the City of London, which covers Holborn. Brilliant bloke called Peter Rees, who you should get him on. He was just, you hear that title, chief planning officer, you think, oh, hello.
Yeah.
Brilliant bloke, can tell you about why London is a world city, with fascinating history about it.
Yeah.
He's a brilliant bloke. And he happened to, I know him, and he told me about the statue being moved. It's London's most dangerous statue, basically. And anyone who knows Holborn Circus will know that pedestrians use that statue to cross. But because the plinth is so high, they then appear suddenly from behind the plinth and get knocked over. And so they're moving it. Don't worry, it's moving about 10 yards to the west.
Fantastic.
To where, if anyone knows the Smiths there, pretty much in front of that. Also known as London's politest statue, because Albert's raising his hat on the statue. That's what it's often called.
See, you're good. I want to hang out with you. You and me together would scare my wife out.
We should take our kids to a museum.
Move along, please. Mark Mason is the book. Land's End to John O'Groats. Very nice to meet you. Afternoon, it's 1:33. This is Ian Lee on BBC London 94.9, sitting in for Robert Elms. He's back next week. I'm having a thoroughly good time. Am I supposed to be enjoying this? I don't know if one is supposed to enjoy themselves so much whilst at work. It's going to get even better as well. Coming up in a few minutes, we've got Tin and Duyeb. I probably pronounced that wrong. He'll correct me on air, which is always good. And Izzy Sutty, who's coming in to talk about the Phoenix Fringe Festival. Don't forget, we've got a couple of notes and queries out there. The statue of Prince Albert in the middle of Holborn Circus, well, that's been answered by Mark. It's being moved. It's being moved about 10 feet along. Apparently, the most dangerous statue in the whole of London. Because it blocks off the view. People use it to cross, and it blocks off the view, and people suddenly pop out from behind it. The other two notes and queries we have got out there at the moment. First one's from Sheila in Islington. The birdcage. It was outside St Martin's Art College. It's moved up a bit now. It's on York Way. It did have a giant swing in there. It was all lit up and all looked fancy. Apparently looks a little bit pathetic now compared to how it once was. What is it? Is it some arty installation? Is it some fancy piece of artwork? 0207 22 42000. And then the second query came from Rod, who was the cab driver that spotted the birdcage with Sheila. I know it's confusing, vaguely incestuous, isn't it? He's talking about the lantern, the Georgian lantern, Admiralty Arch. The middle arch, there's this lantern. It's got four panes of glass in it. Three of them are clear, one of them is red. Why on earth would that be? Is it just that they broke the three other red bits and they could only get clear glass? That happens sometimes. No, that happens sometimes. You know, you sometimes see broken windows and think, oh, we can't get the colour, let's just get a bit of plain glass. I don't think it could be, but you never know. Is it a warning sign? Is it? What on earth is it? One of you will know.
020-722-42000. A little bit of music, shall we? One of my favourite bands, the Bare Naked Ladies. Very disappointed by their new album. It's rubbish. And I've tried it twice, I'm going to try it one more time. I'm never disappointed by them, but this I just thought, oh dear, you've lost your spirit. Well, I'm going to take you back to better times when they hadn't lost their spirit. This is such a... This song, it starts off a little bit down, but it ends in just pure triumph. From their album, Bare Naked Ladies and Me, this is Maybe You're Right. Oh, I was enjoying myself a little bit too much. The Bare Naked Ladies, which is a cracking song. Now, joined now by Tin and Duyeb and Izzy Sutty. Nice to see you both.
Nice to see you.
For goodness sakes, names. This is why Lee isn't my real last name. Well, it is now. I changed it legally by Deepole. My real last name is Rugby. Try spelling or saying that. You can't do it.
Is it R-U-G-V-Y?
No, it's nothing like that at all. You've got the first letter right, and that's pretty much it, I'm afraid. But so that's why I changed mine. You guys have kept with the tricky names. Has it never crossed your mind to help guys like me out?
Well, the thing is, it's got its pros and cons. I mean, obviously the cons are nobody can ever say it, pronounce it, write it. But at the same time, if you Google me, there's only me. That's quite nice.
That's true.
Tiernan was saying that he was going on stage the other day and someone introduced you as...
Dean and Tuyeb, that was nice. Yeah, that was a good one.
What did they call you?
Dean and Tuyeb, they swapped the first two letters.
Oh, that's clever.
And then I had Tier Man as well, that's been quite fun.
Oh, that's just lazy.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
And Izzy, you get the pronunciations of your name.
I get relaxed about it. Well, you see, the problem is no one really knows... It's like one of those recipes for bolognese that's passed through a family and everyone puts their own twist on it. No one really knows how it's supposed to be pronounced and, you know, I say Sooty and then I don't... I don't like Sooty. I think it sounds a bit...
What makes it more difficult, and no disrespect, is you do have a slight accent. So yeah. I'm trying to say, do I say it like I'm saying Newcastle? I go with the accent, or does that sound like when newsreaders talk about the situation in the Palestine? You know, when they kind of do the accent for it. I don't know if that's...
Yeah, but it sometimes sounds a bit... Yes, I know what you mean. Well, the double thing with me is that on the Sooty show, the spell was Izzy Wizzy Let's Get Busy. So that's why at school I used to always get, "Where's Sweep? Where's Sue?
Where is Sweep and Sue? Are they coming in later?
I've got them under the table. Yeah,
nice.
They'll come out later.
So your name's like a Chinese whisper. In that no one's quite know what it started with, but we sort of know where we've ended up.
Yes, and then in years to come, it will have become like a new word.
You're here, not just for, to talk about names, and this could be potentially classed as bullying by me, so I'm going to move on before an email is sent. You're here to talk about the Phoenix Fringe. What on earth is the Phoenix Fringe?
It's an alternative fringe to the Edinburgh Festival that we're running here in London for a week.
Are you chicken? Are you scared of Scotland? What's your problem? Why can't you go up there, you guys?
No, it's not. It's not to do with Scotland. I love Scotland. It's to do with the Fringe, and lots of us comedians are rather sick of the Fringe, partly due to the fact that what a lot of people don't realise is it costs us absolutely thousands and thousands to perform there every year, and pretty much every comedian, apart from a few of the very biggest names, will leave with a massive debt, and you pay to work the hardest you've worked in your life.
And this is true, isn't it? I did it a long time ago. I couldn't be bothered now, but I've got friends that do it, and even if you sell out every night, you're going to lose money, aren't you?
Yeah, because PR, even if you don't get PR, which some people don't, and that's, you know, that's fine, you're still paying so much for the venue and other costs, like
accommodation, living. You live there for a month, but you don't get any pay for a month. My last Edinburgh, I did 2011, and I was on a deal where if I sold 100% of my tickets, I'd have lost $4,500. That's great, isn't it?
Hey, let's support young artists, shall we? Also, there's the booze and drugs you have to buy when you're up there. That's part of the deal. I know how it works up there, guys.
Tax deductible.
Can you get a receipt for that stuff these days?
It's tricky. It can be done.
I remember having a really bad show, well, one of many bad shows over the years in Edinburgh, because you do have sometimes have a few bad ones in a row where you think, I really want to go home. And I worked out how much I was losing per show, and I thought, I'm paying to die for an hour in front of people in raincoats.
But then why do people do it? Are the people, it's been so long since I've been part of that world, are people still looking for that big break to get spotted by a Channel 4 and get their own series? Are they looking for age? What are they doing it for then if they're losing so much money?
I think some of it's creative benefits, like you want to write an hour and you really want to craft it for the month and maybe tour it afterwards or get a run somewhere. But I think also it can be about raising your profile, and perhaps not as cynically as like I want to be, you know, I want to my own sitcom and I won't settle for anything less, but perhaps just to kind of raise people's awareness.
I think that the issue, I mean, it's definitely a reason to do it. And the thing that I certainly miss from doing it is just doing an hour show every day. It's great. It's a great thing to do.
Oh, it's a great really discipline, do a month incredible of like that, yeah.
You end up being, by the end of it, you're a much better comedian when you started. But there's now 2,800 shows a day at the Edinburgh Fringe. So to actually get spotted or seen by anyone or to be picked up for a tour afterwards, is the chance of becoming smaller and smaller and smaller.
I was going to say, does the sort of new, younger comedian stand any chance? Because a lot of the big names got there for a week, 2 weeks, and they get all the attention, they get all the focus, they sell all the tickets at £30 a pop. Can someone who's in their first few years of stand-up or performing in whatever it may be get spotted anymore there?
A very, very small percentage. Yeah. I think there's still the awards and things, but they pick, you know, five people out of 2,800, so it's a very small chance. And, I mean, this is part of the reasons we're starting this London one. For a start, many of us comedians live here, and London's very, very busy in the summer. But also, we're running a fringe where it doesn't cost the comedians anything, and more importantly, for audiences, it's much cheaper as well.
Yeah, some of those Edinburgh tickets are expensive. So this is the Phoenix Fringe. It's the 3rd of August until the 11th of August. Where is it? Is it happening? Is it happening in lots of different venues?
No, it's just happening at the Phoenix, which is a lovely venue on Cavendish Square, just off Oxford Street. And we've got 36 shows. We've got the one show that isn't on the website. Russell Howard is now doing two work in progress shows.
Oh,
there.
Brilliant!
Rufus Howard is doing two brand new improv shows. We've got Alan Davis.
I was about to say, you've got proper people here. These aren't just, you know, people doing their third gig. You've got big names here. This is a great list.
There's an awful lot of comics that aren't in Edinburgh, but really, it doesn't mean they don't want to do a show. And so all the shows aren't. Some of them are a mix of old and new stuff. Some of them are experimental things. It's going to be a very exciting week.
Well, just picking some of these, I'm looking at the flyer you've handed me. You've got Robin Ince, you've got Alan Davis, you've got Mark Watson, you've got Andy Osho, you've got Bob Mills, you've got Pappies. This is a cracking lineup. Why was it easy to get people involved to come on and do this? Was it just phoning around your mates and saying, hey, we're doing this, do you fancy
much. I mean, we just explained to them we're doing an alternative fringe, and that there's very little to lose, and it was in London, and they were all very, very keen. I mean, you can ask Izzy. She was one of the people who rang.
I got a text, and I'm not gigging as much these days, so I was like, no. And then as it got near the time, I was like, oh, everyone's doing the Phoenix Fringe. So I am doing one now, a mixture of...
When are you on, Izzy? What day are you on?
I'm on the 10th at 4 o'clock.
Okay. Oh, so kind of like the Edinburgh Festival, in that there are performances all at different times of the day. It's not just you turn up at 7:30 and you watch a show. There are other bits and pieces going on.
But also, we were saying on the way here, the day tickets are such a good thing because you can go for a bit, go off and get some food, and there's so many places around the Phoenix, or you can probably even eat there upstairs, I would imagine, can you?
Yeah, they've got food there as well.
You say it's good value, how much is it then?
Well, each show is £8 in advance or £10 on the day, but you can buy a day ticket for £20 to see absolutely everything on that day. There's only a limited amount of those, and they are starting to go.
Well, to see Mark Watson for £8, that's, you know, £20 to see that day. You get Monday the 5th, you get Jim Smallman, Mark Watson, Andy Osher. £20, that's good going, isn't it?
And also, it's a lovely room, and it's an intimate room. Yeah. You're not in a massive theatre on the back row trying to decide the person on stage is a human being, you know.
Izzy, what are you doing? Because people will probably know you from Peep Show. I guess that's kind of the advert, isn't it? The people might know you. Also, you've been on Radio 4. You've been doing stand-up for a long time.
Yeah.
What can they expect from your show?
Well, I'm going to be doing a few stories. I've got a story about a Kaylee, because I've started to go to this Kaylee, and there's a really sweaty man there who tries to dance with everyone. But he's really, really drenched in sweat.
Oh, I don't like sweaty men.
But don't you?
I'm not a fan of sweat on other people. I mean, I do sweat. My right armpit's very sweaty. But sweat on other people, it's
only
not...
Only your right?
Yeah, I know. I think it might be glandular before you start having a go. But my other armpit's fine, but the right one, it just drenches. But so your show... Yeah, I know. Sorry, I've gone into too much detail. I feel I know you guys.
I'm going to put you into the Kaylee story now.
No, don't. So you're doing a show about a sweaty man.
Well, I'm doing... So I've got like a 15-minute story about that, because we go to this Kaylee quite regularly. We're all girls, and he tries to dance with everyone, and people say no, and I always feel very sorry for him. So, and I've got a new song about... how people show you pictures of their kids, and it's really boring.
You've not got kids then?
now happen.
I could tell.
I'm sure it'll change if I have them. But that turned into a song about the Smiths. So it's like 4 minutes long, and it started off being about other people's kids, and then by the end, it just become about how much I love the Smiths. So so that's 20 minutes. And then I'll be doing
it. You're just adding it up to
that's what you
how
do.
How can I make an hour?
That is what happens when you're doing, especially a mixture of old and new stuff, isn't it? You kind of think, oh, I've got a new bit that's, oh, so I can, so yeah. So it's a mixture of, but hopefully I'll see what the audience is like. I've got a 6 minute song about Nightmare, which I've just done a remake of for
about Nightmare,
for
the TV
Heat
show
week. Yeah, we did filmed a remake of it last week, and it will be on. That's the best thing I've done this year.
The TV show, where am I now? You're in a room and there's a table and there's a piece of cheese on it.
Yeah, that's right.
Well,
yeah,
you've done a song, 6 minute song about that. That's wonderful.
Yeah, so I did this song and
fantastic.
I got to do the remake, and I was Trey God's new assistant.
It's on YouTube, isn't it?
It's going to be. I think it's this weekend that it's.
Is Trey God in it?
Yeah, Trey God's in it. They've got the real Lord Fear and the real Lister.
So incredibly jealous of Izzy. Oh, you say that.
That's the coolest thing ever.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. But also I'm going to go and see some other shows during the festival, because it really is a good mix of people, I think. And I feel like I'm getting undue credit because I haven't helped organise it.
But listen, you're very funny. I've seen you before. I think you're fantastic. So it's definitely worth coming to see. You're on Saturday, the 10th. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. We're both saying it hesitantly, just in case.
Yeah. No. That's on the website. Yeah. It's because the brochure came out before certain shows were added. So the best thing to do is check.
Is this the first year you've done this?
It's the very first year. Yep. So we're seeing how it goes, and so far it's going very well.
You're selling tickets at the moment, and they're going, aren't they?
Yes. People are
showing an interest.
Yes. Definitely.
And what do you want to achieve from it? Do you want this to become an annual annual event?
That's the thought. I mean, if it goes really well this year, we think maybe we'll do it again next year, but for longer. I mean, London's a great place in the summer.
Yeah.
Why not have a comedy festival? It seems really odd that we don't.
I remember a few years ago, I haven't done stand-up for a long time, but I remember years ago when I did, and it was really easy for rubbish comics like me to get gigs in London, because all the proper ones had gone up to Scotland, hadn't they? But now, it would appear from this list that a significant number are staying in London and, you know, working and wanting to be part of that. Why are they not going to Edinburgh? Is it just the cost? Is it that? Are they tired of it?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of things. It's cost. It's being bored of it. I think that I don't know what you get out of it anymore. I mean, I did it 7 years in a row, and I did sketch shows and mixed bill shows and then three solo shows. And now, actually, I've sort of got an awful lot of work anyway. I don't know what I'd go up to Edinburgh for.
Yeah.
To gain.
It served its purpose.
Yeah. And also, as much as I love Edinburgh, the city, they don't really have a summer there. And, you know, I quite like being at home. I don't really want to live in Edinburgh for a month anymore.
I think what I remember about Edinburgh is it's just exhausting. By the last week, you're dead on
it's
your
so
feet.
It's so hard for people to understand how sick you are of your own show. And if they come up in the last week and they get off the train, they're really full of beans and they're like, hey, what's good to see? And you're just like, oh, get away from it. Being in a pizza restaurant and someone's saying, how's your show going? And I just put my head onto the table and banged my head against the table. I mean, really, really bad behaviour, really.
You get one day off in a month.
Yeah.
It's weird. It's like a Groundhog Day for performers. It's very strange.
And then people say, oh, you're only working for an hour a day, but you're not, because you're worrying about your show 23 hours.
And doing extra shows and promoting it.
Yeah,
and,
trying to.
Oh, you're doing all the free shows, and then you're handing out the flyers on Princess Street. Chilling, you're performing on Friday the 9th. What can people expect when they come and see you?
This is a pretty much entirely new show that I'm doing. It's mainly about opinions and the fact that everyone seems to have one at the moment, and I don't care and I don't want to hear them all. I'm a frequent Twitterer, and it drives me insane. The other day, for example, I tweeted that I liked Simon Pegg's new film, The World's End, and immediately somebody sent me a message going, well, I didn't like it. And I thought, well, I don't... That's not going to change my opinion. Why have you told me? So I've written pretty much an entire show about how sick I am of people, and I hope people come and see it.
The thing on Twitter is when I say something people don't like, and they go, right, well, unfollow. Well, don't tell me you're unfollowing me. Just go away.
Just leave it alone. Yeah.
People, that's why I only say nice stuff.
You do say nice stuff.
I like jam. I don't like jam. Unfollow.
Where can people get tickets from? If they want to book up now, where can they get them from?
Best thing to do is go through the website, which is phoenixfringe.co.uk, or you can go to wegottickets.com and type in Phoenix Fringe, and it brings up our whole list of shows.
Fantastic.
Including the Russell Howard ones, which aren't on the website.
And very quickly, do you want to plug your Twitters as well, so you can get more abuse from people on there?
Sure. The, there's a Phoenix Fringe Twitter, which is at Phoenix underscore Fringe. If you would like to tell me what films you don't like, I'm at Tin and Douya, but you'll have to spell it first. And
Izzy, what's your Twitter?
Mine's at Izzy Sutty, and I'm very interested to know about new flavours of jam, which I can try.
Thank you very much. Best of luck with that. It sounds like a cracking thing. This is Ian Lee, BBC London 94.9. Coming up, Gino De Campo, and hopefully the answers to your notes and queries.
BBC London 94.9.
London's news. London's stories.
Six minutes past two. That's how clocks work, isn't it? Yes, yes. 6 minutes past two. Yeah, that's right. I got it. Ian Lee, BBC London, 94.9, sitting in for Robert Elms. And boy, oh boy, I'm having lots of fun today. What cracking guests. Cracking guests. We need your answers for notes and queries. Also need a little bit of help for tomorrow's show. But first, the notes and queries we've got so far. I think we've solved the problem with the Prince Albert. No, hang on, let me finish that. The Prince Albert statue in the middle of Holborn Circus. Carl called in, he was upset it was being moved. And he said the plinth had been demolished like giant bits of Jenga. It's coming back, apparently, but about 10 feet away. Near the Smiths. Apparently it's the most dangerous statue in London. Other things we got on the go. Well, Sheila called in from Islington, the birdcage. She saw it outside St Martin's Art College. It's moved a bit down York Way. 12-foot-tall birdcage with a giant swing in it. What on earth is that all about? 0207 224 2000. And then Rod in his cab called in. The Georgian lantern, Admiralty Arch. The middle arch, it's got four panes of glass in it. Three of them are clear, one of them is red. Why? We need to get these solved. Come on, please don't let me down, London. I don't want Robert to come back next week and you'll go, ah, we didn't call in for notes and queries because we prefer you, Robert. No, no. 0207 224 2000. I also put it out there, we've been talking about Abbey Road. Are there any other places in London where it's allowed, it's not disallowed, it's not frowned on too much, where people are almost encouraged to leave graffiti? Of course, outside the Abbey Road on the wall, they clean it off every once in a while, but a blind eye is turned to people writing graffiti. Is there anywhere else in London where that has that attitude? Because some graffiti is awful, isn't it? I would suggest the majority. Some of it's pretty darn good, though. Some of it's very funny. Who would think Clapton is actually God? Huh? 0207 224 2000. And also I mentioned the guy who used to walk up and down Oxford Street with the placard. That's the word I was looking for 2 hours ago. Placard. Proclaiming the evils of eating fish and protein. Who on earth was he? What was his name? He's quite a famous one. We should answer that one quite quickly. I'm old enough to have seen him. When would I have seen him, I suppose? Was he around as late as 1990? Was he around as late as then? That's kind of when I started wandering Oxford Street on my own. I was a slough boy, so to be allowed to travel into London was quite a big thing. And Oxford Street became kind of part of my life, 16, 17, 18, 90, something like that. Who was that guy? 020-7224-2000. You can text in 81333. Start your text with London. You can also send me an email, ian.lee@bbc.co.uk. One of my favourite bands in the world. I wish they put their differences to side, and there are differences. Put your curmudgeonly old man differences to side, for goodness sakes. Make another record, XTC, please. Oh, just majestic. Easter Theatre, XTC. It's from Apple Venus Volume 1, which I still consider to be a very recent album. You know you're getting old. When you consider a recent album and you look at it, 1998. Oh, my goodness. Hang on, that's 15 years old. Oh, man. I love XTC. I think they are just the masters. And I once spent a lovely afternoon, well, a whole day at Andy Partridge's house. He invited me round to his house. I spent too long there. I should have just stayed for a couple of hours and then gone, but I couldn't. I was too shy and nervous. I stayed there for 8 hours. He's never invited me back. Shameful. I need a little bit of help as well for tomorrow's show, cover to cover. Okay, you know what that is. For those of you who possibly don't, it's two versions of the same song. Two versions of the same song. I could do with a few suggestions, please. If you've got any ideas of what you'd like to hear in tomorrow's cover to cover, because if you don't suggest something, it's just me going to be, I'll be picking a monkey song. Cards on the table, I'm slightly obsessed, you may have noticed. I'll just be picking a monkey song. So I could do with a few suggestions from you, dear listener. What would you like to hear on tomorrow's cover to cover? It's a cracking idea. The way it works, we play one version of a song, then we play another version of a song. Then the listener phones in and picks the best version, and all other versions are destroyed. No, hang on, we don't quite go that far. But if you've got any suggestions at all, 020 7224 2000, or you can text in with those, that might be quite a good idea. 81333, start your text with London. What your chance to take control of the station. What would you like to hear on cover to cover tomorrow? Notes and queries. We're asking about the Georgian lantern in Admiralty Arch. Why is only one of the sheets of glass in this lantern, why is only one of them red? The others are clear. There's got to be a reason for that. Red, as any 3.5-year-old will tell you, means stop or danger. So is that? It can also mean naughty things as well when it's put up in windows. But what is that all about? 020 722 4000. And there has to be someone out there who is connected or knows someone who is connected with this 12-foot birdcage that Sheila called in about. Sat outside St Martin's College. It's moved down a bit, York Way somewhere now. And it's not looking quite as grand as it once was. What is it? What has it got to do with? Anything? Is it an art display, an installation, I believe? 020 7224 2000. I was also talking about the famous character who used to march up and down Oxford Street proclaiming the evils of protein and fish. Claire's in Stoke Newington. Hello, Claire.
Oh, hello.
Claire, you know the name of this chap, do you?
I do, yes. His name was Stanley Green.
Stanley Green, that's it, of course. I should have known that. When did he stop? I guess he stopped when he died, but when did he stop being part of Oxford Street's furniture?
Well, he died in 93, so he probably, I think he was still walking around, you know, in the early 90s, but he started around the late 60s, because I was at St. Martin's in Charing Cross Road then, and I used to see him a lot, and he's just an icon of Oxford Street.
He is an icon. Did you ever go and speak to him?
I never bought one of his pamphlets. I wish I had now, but I just saw him all the time around Oxford's Circus Tube and Less Passion from Less Protein.
That was it. Less Passion from Less Protein, of course.
Nuts and fish and eggs and sitting.
And what?
Sitting.
Oh, hang on. Was sitting supposed to cause naughtiness?
Yeah, I suppose so, yeah.
Oh, dear. I remember seeing him quite a few times, and I never spoke to him. I wish I had, because I saw people talk to him. He seemed quite normal, didn't he? He didn't seem, apart from, you know, his views on protein and sitting, he didn't seem like, for want of a better word, a nutter, did he?
Well, I think he was a very kind of fairly lonely person. I think he took up this parading up and down Oxford Street when his parents died, and I think he lived with them. He was a bachelor, and I suppose that was his life's mission, just to go up to Oxford Street and walk around. But the Museum of London have got a tribute to him. I think they've actually got his placard and some of his pamphlets.
Have they really?
Tribute. It's in the room that's to do with the sort of 60s, 70s, 80s. So anyone interested can go along there and have a look.
I'm the reason I'm sounding slightly distracted is I'm going on eBay, because I know at one point on eBay they did have some of his pamphlets available, but I'm just looking that no, there aren't any there now, which is a shame. Never mind. Well, maybe while I've got you on the line, Claire, maybe you can answer another question, because Gary emailed in. Someone else who emailed in and got that right. It was Fish the Cabby got that right. But Gary emailed in and said, was it a guy called Philip Howard? Now, Philip Howard, as far as I remember, I may have got this wrong, he was an evangelical preacher, I think, on Oxford Street, who had a megaphone. Does that ring any bells with you?
There were loads of people in Oxford Street around the sort of 70s and 80s who were evangelists, if you like, of one sort and another. But Stanley Green was definitely the protein man.
He was the one.
And he had his own little sort of funny flat cap with a peak.
Claire, you live in Stoke Newington. Final question. Did you ever spot Stokey De Niro, a gentleman with long hair who'd walk around doing Robert De Niro impressions?
If it's the same person I'm thinking of, he was very smart. He always used to dress in sort of camel coats and have necklaces.
Camel coats and necklaces. That's exactly the gentleman. And he would walk around doing the move from Taxi Driver going, you're looking at me, you're talking to me, you're talking to me.
Yes, I knew him, yeah.
Please don't think for one second, anyone. I'm sure that possibly some of these gentlemen, they may have been touched by a little bit of mental illness. I'm not for one second making light of mental illness, if indeed these people were affected by that. But I do miss the characters of London, Claire, the eccentrics. I don't mean necessarily mental illness. I do miss the characters. We don't seem to get those anymore, do we?
No, and I miss them too. And I remember when I used to be going to sort of music festivals, there was a wonderful character called Jesus, who always used to come to the front of the concert and dance wildly and play his bongos in his stripy robes. and he was Jesus, and lots of people knew him, you know, in the sort of late 60s, 70s.
Did he look like Jesus, the long beard, or how we imagine Jesus,
no,
with the long hair?
No, he's got a rather weird pudding base and hairdo with a short fringe and sort of like a bob. But he used to wear these sort of like stripy robes.
Love
and
it.
Sandals and his bongos, and he'd be everywhere. Any festival, you'd always look for Jesus.
Jesus was there. Wonderful. We're all looking for Jesus in many ways, Claire. Nice to talk to you. Thank you very much for calling in.
All right.
Claire in Stoke Newington. Now, when Claire came out with the line, music festivals in the late 60s that she used to attend, I wasn't expecting that. I wasn't expecting that to come out of her mouth. Do you remember Jesus? Did you ever see Jesus in the 60s? I'm sure lots of people did. That's a great character. I was never one for raves in the 80s or 90s or going clubbing. Very, very occasionally I did. Maybe four or five times I found myself in various clubs, in warehouses or things like that. Was never really my scene. I went out with a girl who was into that kind of thing. That's kind of why I ended up there, and I never really enjoyed it. But there would always be someone there with a set of bongos. And as soon as I'd see the bongo, you go to what they used to call it, the chill out room. Do they still call it the chill out room? I hope not, because they would show like silent films on the wall and psychedelic lighting and play ambient music. But there'd always be some numpty with a set of bongos, and you'd be in whatever, you know, worse for wear state. And someone would get the bongos out. You think, oh, for goodness sakes. At some point, this pillock has said, hey, we're going out to a club tonight. Oh, have you got everything? Got the keys? Yeah. Got your wallet? Yeah. Oh, hang on. I'm going to bring my bongos. Yeah, that's a great idea. Bring the bongos, because that's what we need, is a set of bongos. Oh, dear. The bongos played by someone in, in a little... slightly older to say, never a good idea. 0207 224 2000. We're talking about graffiti as well, because of we were talking with Russell Clark earlier on about Abbey Road, of course, the wall outside it, famous for its graffiti. Oliver's on the line. Afternoon, Oliver.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you, Oliver. Are you enjoying? I'm assuming you're calling because you're on school holiday. Is that correct?
Yes, I am on school holiday.
When did your school holiday start?
Well, it started a week ago, last week, on Tuesday.
Are you bored yet?
Not yet. We're going to be going on holiday on Friday to France.
So.
Oh, you're going to France. Well, that'll be nice. That'll be nice. What do you kind of do? How old are you, Oliver?
I'm 10.
10. What kind of stuff do you like doing on your school holidays? Because they do drag on a bit, don't they, those 6 weeks?
Well, yeah, I like playing on my computer and just playing with my Diablo, going on my trampoline, running around the garden like a maniac.
Hang on a second. Playing with your Diablo, that's that. You mean one of those things you toss up into the air?
Yeah.
Wow, look at you. You're a smart young man. Okay, well, maybe you can help me with this. Graffiti. Where are places where it's probably not allowed, but people turn a blind eye to graffiti? Where have you spotted?
Well, surprisingly, there's a legal wall in Alexander Palace by the skate park. And it's a big wall where it's legally allowed. So you're allowed to graffiti there. And some of the art's really nice. There's quite some nice images on Flickr, if you could go on there. Then there's some really sort of nice graffiti.
I know the place very, very well. I used to live in Muswell Hill and we used to go to that park and feed the ducks. It's right by the boating lake, isn't it? So yeah. We'd go and feed the ducks and we'd hire a little peddler with my little boy and then we'd go and play. And my little boy, who was three at the time we lived there, he would just love to watch the skaters. He would sit there and watch it. And I'm thinking, don't get any smart ideas, sunshine, not for another 12 years. But yeah. So you're allowed to do the graffiti there, are you?
Yeah, it's legally allowed. It's just a blank wall, and it's definitely legal. I had the little research, and it's a legal wall where you're allowed to do graffiti, and some people do some really nice things, and it's quite amazing that it's done by graffiti, and some of them look like they've been painted, but they're definitely done by a spray can.
Some of them are fantastic. A lot of graffiti, though, Oliver, would you agree? Is it's a load of our rubbish. Is a lot of it, isn't it?
Well, yeah.
Okay. Have you ever done it?
No.
Are you tempted?
Not really. Like, I get out a scrapbook and, like, do cool little artsy drawings.
Your family sound quite arty. If you're on the Diablo already at the age of 10, I suggest you get a spray can and try it on the dining room wall. Maybe give that a go. See how that gets on.
Yeah, my brother, because we have quite an old house and my brother's quite little, he just gets pencils and starts writing on all the walls.
And I bet your mum and dad love that, don't they?
Well, they mind. They don't really like it.
No.
But because it's an old house and we're going to get it redone anyway, it's okay.
Well, Oliver, lovely to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. One of the joys of knowing that you're going to redecorate your house or paint the walls or put new paper on is writing on the walls. Oh, some of the stuff I've left on walls in houses, outrageous. You're listening to Ian Lee, BBC London 94.9. Gino De Campo is not coming in, so it means we've got extra time to take your phone calls, which works out well for us. 0207 224 2000. 2:30 afternoon, 2:33. Ian Lee sitting in for Rob Elms, BBC London 94.9. Gino De Campo, the chef, was supposed to join us. He can't make it now, which is fine, because that leaves us 27 minutes to have a little bit of a chat to try and solve the two remaining queries. The birdcage that Sheila called in about outside St Martin's Art College, now a little bit further down York Way, and also the Georgian lantern in Admiralty Arch. We'll be talking about graffiti as well in a second. I'll go to John in Kingston in a minute. I'm also asking for a little bit of help for tomorrow's show. Cover to cover is a cracking feature. I love it. One of the highlights, I think, in Robert's catalogue, as it were. You get two songs, the same song done by different people. You compare and contrast, and you pick the best. You pick the winner. We've had some great suggestions in. Dave has said Long Tall Sally, Little Richard versus the Beatles. Ray says, You've Got a Friend, James Taylor versus Michael Jackson. Michael Jackson did You've Got a Friend? I can't believe it's the same song. Sister Morphine, The Rolling Stones versus Marianne Faithfull. I'm not a Stones fan. I never got the Stones. Summer in the City, Loving Spoonful versus Quincy Jones, says Pete. I was keen to go with Hallelujah, Jeff Buckley versus Leonard Cohen. That was suggested by Alice. I was then reminded if I did that, we would probably lose half our listeners. Have I Told You Lately by Rod Stewart and Van Morrison, says Morris. That was in the lead. My new one in the lead at the moment has come from Scott, who's tweeted me. This is my favourite at the moment. First Cut is the Deepest. Cat Stevens versus Rod Stewart. I think, Scott, that's a cracking one. Are we going to get anything better than that before 3 o'clock? First Cut is the Deepest, Cat Stevens versus Rod Stewart. Of course, written by Cat Stevens, but some would say Rod Stewart did the definitive version. Are we going to find anything better than that? That's in the lead for me at the moment, 020-722-42000. Graffiti. Whereabouts in London are you kind of encouraged, or it's not dissuaded? You're not dissuaded from doing graffiti. John's in Kingston. Hello there, John. Oh, John, you've disappeared. We'll come back to you in a second, John. Let me play a record, and then we'll speak to John and see what suggestions he's got for where people can possibly do graffiti. Oh, a bit of Neil Young. He's almost as good as Stephen Stills, isn't he? Almost. Not quite. You cannot go wrong with a little bit of Neil Young at 2:39 in the afternoon. Unless, of course, you're being offered the play of the first Stephen Stills album. Then I would go for that every single time. We're trying to get hold of John in Kingston. I think we have John now. I may have been just pushing the wrong fader, partly because I'm an idiot. John, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
I do apologise, John. Yes. My fingers are a little bit fat, and I'm not very technically minded, so I'm sorry to leave you hanging.
No, it's all right. I'm always glad to hear Neil Young open at the A2 with his original band Crazy Horse from all those years ago. Still going strong.
Can I ask you, John, though? It is obvious, isn't it, that Stephen Stills is better than Neil Young?
Oh. Sorry, no.
Oh, dear. Well, okay, let me try again. Stephen Stills is the better guitarist.
I might agree to that, yeah.
Okay.
I might agree to
better,
that.
Yeah, better singer?
I don't know. Neil's voice is one of those voices, it's like Marmite, I think.
Yeah.
But it's a Marmite I like.
Oh, listen, I like Marmite, and I like Neil Young on my toast as well. Now, hang on a second. But I've got a real... I'm having an argument with a friend, basically, about who's better, Stephen Stills or Neil Young. And sometimes I know that Neil Young is an advocate of just doing things off the hoof, but sometimes I think he suffers a little bit from his spontaneity.
He does, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
OK. Anyway, that's not what you've called in about.
Anyway, yeah, the graffiti... it's a fantastic piece of graffiti,
yep.
And it's on a viaduct over the M25, and it's as you're going clockwise,
yep.
And you've just gone past the M40 turnoff, I believe.
I know exactly what you're going to say, go on.
You know what I'm going to say, don't you? And it's written on the side of the viaduct, it's got, give peas a chance.
Isn't that funny? I drive past that every day.
Peas is spelled P-E-A-S.
Yeah.
And every time I look at that, I always smile. Now, someone said it's been up there since the John Lennon bedding days. I don't really know whether it has or not, but it might be very interesting if there's some knowledgeable listener out there that can phone in and maybe let us know.
Well, it can't have been there, because the John Lennon bedding days were like 1971. The M25, I remember that being built. That was... When did the M25 start? 1980?
Yeah, but the viaduct looks pretty old, though. Maybe they...
You think that's been there longer?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
It is good. Listen, it's not the best pun in the world, give peas a chance, but the fact that someone has taken the time to get up there somehow, lean over there and write it in huge letters, I think that deserves a little bit of respect, doesn't it?
I really do, yeah. I've often thought about that. I thought, well, God almighty, that must have been really dangerous trying to do that even, let alone write on the wall at the same time.
And why we would never encourage vandalism like that. You sometimes have to respect these idiots. Yes, I think you do. John, I'm trying to think of places in London where it's, like Abbey Road, where it's kind of okay-ish to do graffiti. We had Oliver call in about the wall near Alexandra Palace. I'm trying to think of other places where they aren't, you know, kind of free-speaking walls, you know, where it is like Abbey Road, where you're not meant to do it, but it's become such a part of the culture that people go, oh, we'll paint over it in 6 months. Go on then, do what you want to do. Are there any places that you can think of?
I'm so sorry. I just can't think of anywhere like that.
John, listen, you've called in with a cracker. Thank you. How long has that Give Peas a Chance been there? It can't have been there since the early 70s, can it? I see it every single day. I know exactly what he means. And I hadn't noticed it before. You know when you drive around the M25, you don't really notice things. And someone mentioned it to me, and I, oh, yeah, I know that, Give Peas a Chance. It's not the best pun in the world. There are better. But the dedication that someone one night said, right, tonight, come on, grab that tin of paint and that paintbrush, we're going out. Where are we going? Going to go and paint on a bridge. Really? Yeah, bring those bongos. We might need those as well. 020-722-42000. We're trying to find a cover to cover. I've been informed by Peter Stevens. Any relation to Cat? Probably not. That the first cut is the deepest may have been done already. So, I don't know. Well, that, at the moment, that means that in the lead, we've got Rod Stewart versus Van Morrison. Have I told you lately? Some more have been sent in. Brown Eyed Girl, Van Morrison versus Jimmy Buffett from Wayne. Fool If You Think It's Over. No, it involves Chris Rea. I can't do Chris Rea. I can't, really. Oh, hang on a second. We may have a winner. I'm a Believer, Neil Diamond versus the Monkees. That's from Laurie. Bridge Over Troubled Water, Elvis versus Simon and Garfunkel. I'm a Believer, the Monkees versus Robert Wyatt. Possibly. Has Bridge been done before? We've done that one. Okay, look, I'm getting stern looks from the producer. We've done that. No, we're not doing that. I'm a Believer, Neil Diamond versus the Monkees. I tell you what could be a good one, actually. Daydream Believer, the Monkees did a cracking version. Also, Anne Murray did a superb version in about 1981, I'm thinking. I'm not totally sure. 0207 22 4 2000. What's your thinking on that? We need help. We're coming up with songs for cover to cover for tomorrow. Peter Stevens is working overtime on the email. He's coming up with some cracking suggestions for cover to cover. Baby, I Love You, the Ronettes versus the Ramones. Ooh, that could be nice. We're getting a good list. Send them in. We won't make the decision now. We will make the decision before tomorrow's show, obviously. That would be ridiculous not to. I quite like that one, though. Oh, it's a good... Once you start thinking about it, it's a good game to play. Oh. Who smashed those bottles? This is Ian Lee, BBC London 94.9, sitting in for Robert Elms, here for the rest of the week. I think he's back next week, so don't panic. I'm having quite a bit of fun. OK, right, let's have a little look to see what else we've got. Talking about graffiti, Norman's in Harrow. Hello, Norman.
Hiya there.
Yes, Norman, can you hear me?
Yeah, I got you fine, yeah.
Oh, good lad, Norman. What can I do for you?
Well, I remember in the 70s, I was an electrician.
Yes.
And we wired Helena Rubinstein's apartment.
Oh, right, very nice.
And she had a penthouse in Knightsbridge.
Yeah.
And when she gave a press launch for a new product...
Yeah.
The toilet and bathroom in her apartment were all painted black. And she left a box of chalk in there for all the journalists to write graffiti on the walls.
Oh, blimey.
Yeah.
And what kind of stuff were they writing, though?
Well, some of it was pretty risque and rude.
Yeah.
So I'll give you one piece that's always stuck in my mind.
Is it clean, Norman? I'm not going to get the sack, am I, before the end of the week?
I'll cut the end bit off for
you. Bless you for that.
All right?
Yeah.
And it said, don't beam me up yet, Scotty. I'm just going to have a... And the S went right up to the ceiling.
Oh, dear. We don't get graffiti. We don't get proper kind of toilet graffiti anymore. You go to public toilets; they're all got that anti-graffiti paint on, or people scrub it off. That's kind of the only reason anybody would use a public toilet, is to see the clever, in inverted commas, witticisms that people have decided to write on the wall. I miss that stuff.
Yeah, well,
Norman, thank you very much indeed. Not a fan of public toilets. Some of them are pretty grotty. A lot of them closed down, of course, because of some of the shenanigans that took place in there. But I do miss that. I do miss the... and again, I'm not in any way condoning graffiti, but before you kind of jump and have a go at me. I do miss the kind of smuttiness and the innuendo and the jokes that used to be written on toilet walls. You don't get that anymore, which is a real shame. 0207 22 4 2000 is the telephone number if you want to give me a call. We're still looking for a song for cover to cover to be played on tomorrow. You know how it works. The same song, done twice by two different people. If you can think of any, then give us a call. Oh, I've just remembered some great places with graffiti. If you want to see some good graffiti, start a rubbish band and go and play in some dives around London. The 100 Club... It's not that that's a dive, but the 100 Club in Oxford Street. Last time I was there, who was I with? Last time I was there, oh dear. I was there with Frank Sidebottom, may God rest his soul. The wonderful Frank Sidebottom. We were doing a gig together. I've never seen a man in a paper mache head so drunk in all of my life. It was wonderful. I love Frank. I was so upset when he died. It was wonderful. There were about 35 people there. Frank was very, very drunk, and he was supposed to do 20 minutes. An hour and 20 later, he was still going on. It was a joy. But what made me think of that is the dressing room, and I use that word very, very loosely. I say dressing room. It's a store cupboard, really. But the walls in there are just covered in wonderful, wonderful graffiti from some fantastic bands. I'm trying to think, the Monarch, the Camden Monarch as well, has got great graffiti from bands. And a lot of those places get painted over as well. No, never paint over those. Those are rock history. Dear listener, that stuff should be preserved. That stuff should be taken down and put in museums, shouldn't it? On the email, Brenda says, you can do graffiti along Parkland Walk in Finsbury Park. It's a nature walk which takes you from the park to Highgate. I'm trying to think where that is. As you say, some of the art is good and some doesn't make any sense at all. I can't think where that Parkland Walk is. Is it the walk where I'm going to ask a question as though you're going to know the answer. Is it where I used to go jogging with my mate Dave? Is it? You probably don't know the answer to that, do you? I realise, as I said, it was actually quite a stupid suggestion. Suggestion for cover to cover, says Tony. Go Now, the Moody Blues versus the original by the Southern Soul goddess Bessie Banks. Trust me, it'll work. Ian, how about Sheik's original of At Last I Am Free compared to Robert Wyatt's cover from the LP Nothing Can Stop Us? Can I just say, and I know that, again, that to some people this is blasphemy, I'm not a huge Robert Wyatt fan. I like the fact he exists, or existed. I like the fact that he made records, because I think it's good when unusual people, that's me being polite, make records. I never got it, though. I never really got it. Oh, Pat's come in with a good one. Everybody's talking, Fred Neil versus Harry Nilsson. There is a wonderful Harry Nilsson box set been released. 17 CDs. It's about 50 quid. It's about 50 quid for 17 CDs. Oh, that's a bargain. Unless anybody wants to send it to me free so that I can review it. Oh, you can't do that in the BBC. Point taken. I don't like Mondays. Boomtown Rats versus Tori Amos. Tori Amos did that? Really? She's delightfully bonkers. Elvis versus Neil Diamond. The Grass Won't Pay No Mind. Yeah, it's a little bit slow and sullen, that song. It's a great song. I know both versions very, very well. I was born and raised on Neil Diamond. But maybe it's just a little bit too maudlin for that. I think this is one has been done, hasn't it? Got to Get You Into My Life, The Beatles versus Earth, Wind and Fire. Has it not been done? Have a look at the list. We have what is laughingly called the Bible here, which is a list of... the Beatles wouldn't be done. No, because Robert doesn't like it. Does that mean we can't do it, or we can sneak a Beatles track in? We need to check. I don't want to offend Robert. Of course I don't. Listen, I'm fully aware this is his show and I'm his guest here. But maybe that wouldn't have been done. Who knows? We'll see. Peter says, oh, look, Peter, may God bless you. What a way to end the show. He has sent me a picture of the wall of the 100 Club dressing room. And look at that. Isn't it a masterpiece of graffiti? What a fantastic image to end on. Thank you so much. Well, that's me done for another day. I'm thoroughly enjoying this week. I'm here until Friday. Rob's back next week, don't worry. But thank you for everybody who's calling in and making me feel so welcome. Jo Good's up next. She's talking to a man who was, get this, shipwrecked for 76 days, was the inspiration for the novel Life of Pi. Well, that's got to be worth listening to, isn't it? I've been Inley. I am back tomorrow at midday.